I've had to learn through pain to, like, the what trust does.
Yeah.
Right? It actually gives power, right? And I think people that aren't worthy of trust, right, will find their way out. They'll be very uncomfortable in an environment like that, right? And you won't need to terminate someone. They'll kind of self-elect. And my hope really is to invite them to learn to use trust themselves in reverse.
We are honored to have Matt Frisbee, marketing genius, dedicated family man, sage of the business and personal brand. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. That's quite an intro. What are you talking about?
Well, we are honored, and I'm excited to get to know your story, and I'm supposed to ask about pies.
Oh, tell yeah. Us, we'll talk about pie. That's
tell
good.
Tell us what that means and how it affected your family.
Okay. Should we start with pie?
Unless you have a better topic. I mean,
not really.
It seems juicy. Really, yeah. Pies.
Sugar, dough, all the right things. Yeah. So I'm originally from California. Family grew up there. I grew up in Buena Park, California is where we started. And my family, actually my folks still live there. And great place, great community. I thought I'd live and die in California. Played football and basketball out there. Ended up working for Disney. Randomly got that. I was in the Disney College program. Then I got hired to be an entertainer. And it was fun. It was a lot of fun. It was kind of a dream come true. And while performing in shows, I met some folks that worked for the art department. And I was like, no way. I was going to school to be an artist at Cal State Fullerton. And I applied for a position there and got it almost immediately. And I thought I was going to die. Just like, I can't believe I'm a Disney artist. And I started out being an artisan, and I worked in what's called the Olive Fabrication Shop, which supported the resort. And we worked on some really cool things. This is kind of 2003. Did that okay. for a few years.
And right. What type of artists are we talking about? Are we talking about paint, calligraphy? Mm-hmm. Like, what are we talking about?
So graphics, signs for shows in the park. Painting sets and props and for different resort shows, entertainment. And I worked with carpenters. And so any type of like non-resort ride, that was us.
Cool.
So if it was Fantasmic or, you know, Aladdin's on stage, the Tomorrowland shows, and it was pretty neat. And then they told us, like, you know, we're gonna do a Star Wars show. We were like, huh? You know, like, you know, and this is before the new movies launched and all that, but it was really cool. We worked on Pirates of the Caribbean. That was the longest red carpet in the history of Hollywood at the time, and must have aged 100 barrels, and, you know, it was just fun. And I was definitely the underling. There were some extremely talented artists that I was working under, and watching them work and looking at their portfolios and the things they were creating was extremely inspiring. And there was a lot of people that wanted these jobs, and I just felt very honored. It was really neat.
That's cool. What was it like working with these other cast members and designers? Where were they coming from? What did you learn from them? What was the culture like?
It was amazing. Leaving Disney was a shocker. It was so good. You kind of get jaded after a while because you start getting involved in kind of department politics and just struggles with personnel at work. And I had been there through high school, like from high school through college. I'd been there for 7 years and I was kind of ready for something different. And it's not, you're not meant to like raise a family like on some of these jobs. It's just not good enough pay in Southern California to, you know, raise four kids. But we didn't have four kids at the time, but eventually, you know. So the people, though, were amazing. It was really neat to just the talent. And they came from all over the world. And it was amazing how many people believed in the Disney company. So it was just neat, especially when we launched the Disney Cruise Line. They were literally from all over the world, Denmark and Tokyo and
when was that,
Brazil.
That Disney Cruise?
That was 06.
Okay.
It was in the Long Beach ports is where we were doing events out there. And that's right when I was exiting. And it was just great. It was really neat. And it wasn't until I left, I was like, whoa. And I started building a company of my own. I'm like, if I just tried to provide the benefits that Disney provided, that would be the only thing I did. And just a great company, and the longer I've been away, the more I've appreciated the amazing job I had at the time. It was a great college job.
So did I miss pies, though?
Yeah. You sure did. Yeah, we skipped right over. We covered that about an hour ago. So my last name is Frisbee, and I got into genealogy pretty hard a few years ago, and I found a website, and it's the FFFAA.org, Frisbee Family Association of America, and I was like, we have a website, you know, my dad's cool. Like, I don't know. And I'm like, what do you mean you don't know? You know? And so I reached out in the contact form and they responded. And so it's a genealogical group that just does family history. And I learned that the Frisbees helped settle Jamestown. And okay. So there's like five Frisbee spellings. And mine is the proper one, obviously.
Of course.
Yeah, obviously. It has to be. So it's F-R-I-S-B-I-E. And kind of halfway through the 19th century, the Frisbee Pie Company had started in Connecticut. And these pies were made for college students. And so when they were done eating, they'd turn that pie tin over and chuck it at each other. And there was holes in the back that would make a whistling sound. So that was the deal. It was blueberry pies and apple pies. And apple pies at the time, you put a slice of cheddar cheese on it.
Okay.
And so it wasn't loaded with the sugar that we load it with now, right? It was just like fruit and cheese. So you've had apples and cheese. Like that doesn't... But if you bake it, you're like, whoa. Right?
Yeah, like melted cheese.
Gross. Yeah. It's actually delicious.
Do we need a cookie with that?
You might. You might want to think about that.
Cheese and apples on a cookie. Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, and it's you're welcome. And I'll take, 1% royalties on that. But so I thought it was fun. I'm a big foodie. I love restaurants and chefs and thinking about food, talking about food, international food. So I asked about it, and they're like, oh, yeah, well, that closed up in the 50s. And if you go on eBay, you can buy original Frisbee pie tins. So I found some, and I was like, wow, this is cool, you know. And so they said, actually, this guy just restarted it in 2017, you know. And I was like, who? And so we tried to connect, and there was a frisbeepie.com, and it looks like he tried to restart. So this guy was from Pepperidge Farms. He tried to restart it like a brand that existed, and I reached out to him, and he's like, yeah, it didn't really work, you know, and I'm like, well, what happened? And he's like, well, I'm no good at marketing, you know, and I'm like, what? You know, that's all you need, you know? Yeah. And he's like, yeah, but it's dead now. And I'm like, come on, man, like, let's do this. And so he ended up just selling it to me, so I bought it, and I've got all the dyes and the packaging and the merchandising and the rights to the pie company. So I own the Frisbee Pie Company, and right now it's a piece of paper.
Yeah.
it's an articles of incorporation. My friend Josh helped me get it organized. So my kids and I, we make pies. So we do some for the holidays. But the plan is eventually to launch the Frisbee Pie Company and sell recreated pie tins, aprons, cookbooks, sundries, all the things to make pies. Because making and selling pies is actually really hard to ship it and commissaries and the whole thing. And it's just not my core thing. But it is really neat to have all that in our home, and we talk about it a lot. I just made some pies the other day, and I had never made a pie until that day. I'd eaten a lot, but I never made one. It's actually pretty hard. I use lard in my crust,
okay,
and it's delicious. It's flaky, and we have a lot of fun with it. So we do apple, blueberry, mixed berry, pumpkin. I do a dark chocolate cream that is second to none, and I stand by that.
Sounds like somebody else I know that's never made cookies.
Really?
I eat them, though.
And I'll eat
your pies, man.
All right, happy to help.
I just live down the street. I'm in Pleasant Grove. I know you're just kind of shitting on that before the show started. That's where I live, though.
Well, I had a lot of humble pie about that, and I have come to love Pleasant Grove. I've coached flag football for years, and I love PG. Yeah,
so we're pretty close, right? I mean, it's...
So I lived in PG for a while. I moved to Cedar Hills just recently.
Cedar Hills is probably just, 5-10 minutes away.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
So pies are deep, and, you know, this podcast is about achievement and different things, but you talked about restaurants and international chefs. Is there a rabbit hole we need to dive down there, or is that, just leave it at that?
We could talk about food for 8 hours and wouldn't be enough. Some really good friends of mine, Mary Crafts, Caleb Crafts, Ryan Crafts, inspired me about how much they care about, think about, and deliver food. My mother loved to take us out a lot. And so she was a banker and, you know, really successful executive. My dad made some of the best food I've ever eaten. And so he would, no recipe, just kind of, sometimes he'd swing and miss, and we're like, Dad, like, what were you thinking, you know? And other times you're like, whoa. And he couldn't recreate it because it was, you know, just what was in the cupboard that night. So food was a big part of growing up. But meeting the Crafts family, I did their marketing for a time. I was so inspired by the art behind it, and I learned a lot from them about what food is, its origins, and culturally significance, and how we look at it differently here. And I've probably watched a million shows on it, but going and traveling and seeing cultures expressed through food was very meaningful to me. So my grandma is such a host, and we would have Thanksgiving for hours and hours at her home growing up. And she made two types of stuffing, the stovetop one everyone's familiar with, and then this kind of sausage-based one. I remember when we first got married, my wife was like, what is this? And I'm like, I think you mean it's amazing. Like, what's your deal? You know, and she wouldn't eat it. And she's like, it's just so meaty. And I'm like, I know, you know. And I was in Ireland on a golf trip, and we were staying at this wonderful hotel, and I was getting breakfast, and it was my grandma's stuffing. And I'm like, no way. No, it was exactly the same, you know. And I'm like,
really?
Wait, grandma's Irish. You know, and I called her, and she's like, yeah, you know. And I'm like, right, right. And so it was just neat to see, you know, your history and different things expressed in other cultures. But 100 Foot Journey is one of my favorite movies, and that's basically food porn. And it's
100 Foot Journey.
You ever seen it?
No,
I haven't heard of it.
Yeah, it's a super predictable, super charming film.
Okay.
But it's about an Indian chef who works for a French restaurant trying to get its second Michelin star. And it's just a charming, charming film and beautiful food. So, yes.
Ratatouille? How about that?
It's up there. It's in the top 50.
I know that one. I watch that with my kids.
Yeah. So we love making it and talking about it. Wow. We host a lot and we cook a lot. So,
cool.
Favorite food?
Brisket.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah.
We just had for lunch. R&R barbecue brisket.
Yeah. They do a great job. I miss the original R&R. It's cool to see it offered in so many places. But
Where was the original at?
Downtown off of 6 West. It was just this little shop, probably the size of this booth. And it was amazing. You could smell the brisket a mile away, and you knew you were nearby. And so it's hard to scale that, but then they still do a great job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, cool. So, you, Matt, your background now is marketing.
Yeah.
Before, you said it wasn't. And now you've learned it because of that. Did you start a marketing business then?
Yeah. So I was actually a classically trained illustrator. I thought I'd be an animator growing up, or a Top Gun pilot, because that's kind of the same thing. But I wanted to be a Disney animator. I went to illustration school, and I hated animation. I hated recreating my drawings. So I stopped doing animation, and I got into illustration. Loved that, and thought I'd be doing that. And I'm like, oh, there's not like jobs for this, you know? And it was extremely competitive. And I also didn't understand the market I was getting into. So going to school, I ended up winning an award for the school, and they sent me to Comic-Con. And I created a graphic novel as part of my senior project and did a storyboard animatic and had a lot of fun with editing, ended up getting into film producing. While at Comic-Con, I met a producer at Dark Horse Entertainment, and that began a lot of meetings and pitches, and we ended up getting production capital for a film that, right as we got that agreement, the writers went on strike, and that went away, and became a really frustrating 4 years. But we met a lot of great people, and we produced a lot of scripts, and we got to make a lot of spec pieces, and so that was a very expensive time of our life. And around that time, a really good friend of mine was at One-on-One Marketing, and his name's Ryan Sharp. And kind of an answer to a prayer came to me and said, hey, I want some help starting a marketing business. He was a creative director and a very, very good one, and wanted to do conversion optimization work. And so he knew I was good with people. He was extremely introverted. And so after some prayer, I decided to change things and work with him. But at the time, I didn't know a thing about marketing. I didn't know what SEO was or any of that. And I was kind of, hey, dude, I don't know anything about this, but I learned quickly, and I would love to understand it. What I fell in love with marketing is that I learned that marketing was storytelling with an operation behind it. And I was like, oh, all right, like I can get into this. And I really enjoyed entrepreneurs, and that they'll take risks and they'll put their whole heart and their whole life into creating something, and telling their stories became very real for me, and I fell in love fast. And I think the timing and location worked out. That's when Utah's kind of tech bubble really started to grow. A lot of cool new businesses in the area.
What year was this?
This is 2010.
Okay.
Simultaneously, I want to thank Jeff Rust and Logan Wilkes, who started Corporate Alliance, and Jared Stewart, the three of them. They create a lot of business networking, and I learned that's my superpower. I'm fantastic at networking. I love being around people. I'm as extroverted as it gets. And I get energized by being around people. So I flourished in that, and I learned a ton really fast from fantastic entrepreneurs and others. And so we grew our marketing business in that. It was an agency of just a couple people, and kind of grew over the years and took on different shapes and faces. And we eventually grew to about 15 employees. And then we ran that for about 10 years.
Awesome. Super cool. With your background, I mean, now that you're understanding marketing, what do you find is missing in most brands?
That is a big question. That's a giant depends. It depends. Mm-hmm. I've worked with some a lot of product companies. I've worked with services. I've worked with if you can imagine that we've done marketing for them. Wow, what's missing? The hard one is endurance. There's kind of a low patience for marketing. Mm-hmm. The ROI term is thrown around rapidly because it's easy to, what am I getting out of this? And I think it's important for brands to think, what am I giving to this? To build a customer base is a very difficult thing. To be committed to marketing long term is a very difficult thing. And making it a part of your operation. Peter Drucker is known as saying that marketing and innovation are the only two drivers of a business. Everything else is a cost. And you can talk to entrepreneurs that know that, but doing that is hard. Yeah. It's cash outlay. It's extremely difficult.
Yeah, patience. I heard that. I'm like, oh.
Yeah, I'm out. Ugh. Yeah. That's my second favorite word.
Like patience. I have to have it done today or it's because I might die tomorrow.
Right. Yeah. And urgency is different than patience.
Uh-huh.
And so if you're asking what's missing, that requires incredible discipline, is to seeing it all the way through. Mm. But you can also be wrong, you know? And being right, actually, I've learned, has more to do with endurance than it has to do with creativity.
I agree. Sticking to the plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do brands do that and pivot and work with teams? Because sometimes it's really easy to get upset with marketing and say it's not working.
That's actually a really great point. I was talking about that earlier today. I think the reason it's easy to get upset with marketing is it's confusing. There's something new in marketing every 5 minutes, but there's not. And so marketing, like I said, it's storytelling. Whatever medium that you use, how are you using that medium? Mm-hmm. And so it's important to have a story first, because if you're like, I need money, that's advertising. Right, marketing is the whole thing. It's the whole. It's CX. It's product. It's strategy. It's product launches. It's all of it. Right, and so it's really difficult to give yourself. It's like saying operations is temporary.
Yeah,
it's not. Right, marketing is a piece of the business that drives new business, and so your commitment to it and understanding is difficult because it seems like there's so much, and it's not your story. It's your customer story. And a lot of companies want to talk about themselves and their features and their benefits, and nobody cares.
No one does.
You know, tell me my story, right? And there's a lot of great books that help you do that. There's, you know, Story Brand, and, you know, Robert McKee's book Story is actually my favorite. Story Brand is an iteration of the book Story by Robert McKee. And so it helped that I worked in film for a minute because I learned a lot about telling great stories and the hero's journey. But we all are the hero of our own story. And so if brands can get in the head and heart of their customer, tell your customer story, mm-hmm. right? If you're selling cookies or you're selling...
So give me, let's give us an example of that. How do we tell the customer's story? What does that even mean for cookies? And this is because I don't know anything with marketing. So bear with me.
Me either. We're going to struggle here. Yeah. I'll give you an example at Little Giant. So I was the CMO there for about 3 years and really, really, actually almost four. So great ride. Love working with them. They're a brand that is very willing to advertise and did for a long time. And so we created an avatar. His name's Chris Lee. And so Chris is actually a really good friend of mine. But he is an electrician, and he has an electrical company. So you and I will buy two or three ladders in our lifetime. Uh-huh. So our LTV is like $800, right? Chris will probably buy $30,000 worth of ladders in his career. Do I want to sell to you, or do I want to sell to Chris?
Yeah, Chris, for sure.
Right.
All day long.
So I want to be in Chris's head and heart. So I literally invited Chris, and I was like, hi. Right? And we hung out for 3 days. Uh-huh. And I learned everything I could about his business, and we took him to dinner and we just listened. And then we met more Chris's, right? Mm-hmm. And so what's interesting is that we talk about safety a lot. There's a lot of people that get hurt on ladders, but Chris is probably the safest guy I know, but you would see him as kind of aggressive. He wants you to see him as fearless and organized and powerful. And I was like, fear, interesting. And so what we talked about was his willingness to do dangerous things, mm-hmm. because he has to get 27 feet off the ground moving high power cables to run power through your home. It's dangerous,
yeah.
right? And you pay him for that. So we played with these ideas around his willingness, right, and what's important to him. And so I looked at brands that he follows. I looked at, you know, conversations that he's involved in. He's political, right? There's these things. And so if, you know, kind of like what would Chris do became the conversation. And so we really tried to unpack what was important to Chris. And we'd ask him, like, does this resonate with you? And he's like, that, that, that. And he showed us like flannel brands that he buys from. And we're like, And so it really helped us to unpack that. And that kind of became our research that helped us then build creative and storylines that we would launch our products through. And that really helped us to be in his head. And then he felt very understood.
Yeah. Okay. That's awesome. Really good example. Switching gears here, entrepreneurship and work-life balance.
Yeah, man, that's a sensitive subject. I was divorced this last year, and I would say I did not figure it out. And I think that there's a lot of things that go into it, but I just came back from Moab a weekend with my kids, and we had a blast. And I was thinking about the phrase of spending time. Uh-huh. Because you can spend money, right? But spending time, like you, all of us got 24 today.
Yep.
Equal, right? There's no difference between us. We each get to spend that the same. We don't spend money the same. Some have more, some have less, but it doesn't change your time spend. And so what am I going to spend my time on? Am I going to spend my time on improving my health? Am I going to spend my time on relationships with my family? Am I going to spend my time on building my business? And it's hard because I've got a tech startup I'm building right now, and I want to spend my time on building this big thing. But I committed to spending time with my family because of what I want with my family. So I have to spend less on business and spend more with family. And I had that backwards for a long time. And it built a good business. I learned a lot, but it came with a really terrible price.
Yeah, that's something that, I mean, I think everybody struggles with in the entrepreneurship. You're like, this is my baby.
Yeah.
You know, and then it's like, oh, but you have to spend these other things. And you have to do what you love. And it's like, well, I love this.
you know?
And then you could justify it that way.
Yeah. And it's interesting. Like, this is my baby. Like, I have four babies.
Yeah.
Those are my babies.
Yeah. Those are the real babies.
What are their ages?
So I've got 24. She's 23. She'll be 24 in May. 17, 14, and 10. So I've got quite a spectrum. I actually just had a grandbaby this last year. So
awesome. Rats.
I'm the coolest grandpa in the universe. That's true.
Sure.
My granddaughter's a Packers fan at 2 months old.
For sure you are, man.
Being a grandfather is the coolest feeling in the history of feelings. Seeing your baby have a baby, it was pure magic. It was absolutely magical. And it comes down to more like now I have more time to spend with family. And I choose that. Mm-hmm. So the balance part, though, one of the things I've learned is trust. The law of attraction brings things to you. And one of the things that gets in the way of that is expectation. And so I've had to like set expectation aside and increase trust. And so with this company that I'm building now, I've been amazed at what is coming our way. And I think that we're building something great, but that trust comes with patience. Mm-hmm. And so like rapid growth companies sound super dope, you know, but there comes with the price, you know, and if you've got something great, it will be great, you know, and you got to kind of trust the process. So that's where at least I'm at personally is trusting that things are coming our way. So I spend my time very carefully and I'm not wasteful with my time.
Yeah.
But we've had some really great things come our way and I'm grateful that they are.
And I'll add, I like to trust the process, but I think a lot of that is also trusting the team.
Uh-huh.
Because that's hard. Like, okay, I'm going to put down my phone for the weekend or after five. Like, that's the cutoff, and I'm going to trust that if there's an emergency, somebody else will figure it out, which is scary. But, I mean, this last year has probably still worked a lot, but it's probably the year that I worked the least. I was in Mexico for a few months and with the family, and it was also the biggest growth of any business that I've had, but that trust was definitely hard. Trusting the process, but trusting that the team and the employees that I'd hired can figure it out. And they're a lot smarter than me. I just have to trust them.
No, that's real. It's funny, I had a conversation with a previous business partner. So my buddy Derek, I bought his company Rivetal, and we kind of merged our organizations together. And I had previously felt like a bit of a micromanager because mm-hmm. I was so passionate about getting everything done right now and crushing it for every customer and being absolutely perfect. So I reached out to my original partner, Ryan, and I was like, hey, was I a micromanager? And he's like, oh, yeah. I'm like, that's gross. You know, and I'm like,
love the honesty.
I'm sorry. And he's like, no, dude. He's like, you cared, but yeah, you were, you know, you were there. And I'm like, okay, I can deal with that. And so I asked Derek, and I was like, was I a micromanager? And he's like, yeah, sort of, you know. And I'm like, okay, that wasn't as bad. So then my last organization, I talked to my creative director, and I was like, was I a micromanager? And he's like, oh, no. In fact, I wish you would have engaged a little more. And I'm like, really? Aw. You know?
Thank you.
Yeah, I did it, Mom.
I'm improving.
Right? Yeah. And then with this organization, there are times where I won't hear from team members for like 2.5 weeks, and I'm not worried at all. And, you know, and so the one member of our team showed up with like an elephant on his shoulder. He's like, I killed this giant thing. And I'm like, of course you did. Right? And I've had to learn through pain to like what trust does.
Yeah.
Right? It actually gives power. Right? And I think people that aren't worthy of trust, right, will find their way out. They'll be very uncomfortable in an environment like that. Right? And you won't need to terminate someone. They'll kind of self-elect. And my hope really is to invite them to learn to use trust themselves in reverse. And likewise, when I get asked to do something, I hope I deliver at that level. Because yeah. When your team delivers at that level, you're like, okay, like I also need to bring back an elephant, right?
Yeah, that's super cool. Personal branding, let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah.
That's something that me personally, I'd never done till just under a year ago. I was like, okay, I need to build a personal brand. I need to post more than twice a year for my kid's birthday. What's the importance of a personal brand versus your business brand?
That's a good point. I've actually only recently gotten back to LinkedIn. And I kind of just post stuff on Facebook and Instagram about family to kind of share with relatives. I feel like that my personal brand is stronger in person. I network a ton in person. And so I can kind of travel anywhere and run into somebody I know. But that's 14 years of constantly networking.
Uh-huh.
And I'm really grateful for that. My digital presence is not that strong. But there's some people I think handle it really well and very authentically. Like I love Nate Randall. He's the CEO of Gab. Mm-hmm. And he offers his page to people that are looking for jobs and offers his page to moms in need. And it's a very selfless approach, you know. So I think you kind of have to be okay with which path you're going to take. I really like the networking piece. And I'm well networked in this market. And so I want to continue to do that. And that's worked really well for me, but it requires a lot of in-person time. And for an extrovert, it's magic, right? And so I think there's just different ways to go about it, but I'm always looking to take someone out to lunch. And I always want to break bread with people. So that's my personal brand. I get hit up for where should I eat, you know? And I certainly don't know all the best places, but I love breaking bread with people. And so I'm very much, that's my thing.
What has that done for Law of Attraction? You talked about that earlier.
Yeah.
What has come to you because you're doing these things that maybe don't scale the best, but it's that personal touch?
Scale, I think, is an interesting term. When you put it out there that you're doing whatever, right? You're making delicious cookies with the dough in the center that I want one right now. You tell the world about that, people become aware of it and they bring things to you. And so we launched a company in November that is about apprenticeships. And so I put it out there to my network, you know, hey, you know, we're working on this. We need some beta customers. People are like, hey, you should talk to so-and-so. Hey, I get these phone calls and emails. You should talk to so-and-so. And it just happens because you talk about it, because you share it, right? And I genuinely want to learn. And so I offer that up. And then you help others with theirs. And so I think just that giving nature of helping everyone with their situation, there's a book called Never Eat Alone. And I'm trying to remember his name. It's like... Frank, no, it's Ferrazzi is his last name. So Ferrazzi is his last name, but great book, Never Eat Alone. And I live by that principle. And so when you share, it gets returned to you. So
I love that. And when you talk about failure, what has helped you and what have you learned from as far as like failure in your past?
I've done it a lot. When you fail for a client, that hurts. They've given you money. You didn't deliver on what they thought. So steep learning there. I've learned to really value it. I've learned to unpack it and what happened. And when I went in-house at Little Giant, my father said something that was really important for me to understand. So I was a CEO of a company. We had about 15 employees. And, you know, we ran it for 10 years. I was very comfortable, great lifestyle as a result. And the idea of going in-house at a brand, I was leery of, because I'm like, I'm the captain of my ship. Why would I want to get on your boat, right?
Yep.
And I loved the team over there. I loved the founders and the CEO and the group over there. Great people, very inspirational people. That wasn't the problem. It was just autonomy. Mm-hmm. So my dad said, the best leaders are excellent followers. And that landed hard with me. And so when I went over there, I was having to let go of something that I've been building, and could I follow someone and watch them fail and fail with them? And that was harder than failing on my own, because I only had so much influence. But we failed and won together. And that was interesting to be on a bigger team. But I think that you have to embrace it. It's like anything in adventure, right? My boy's mountain bike. You are going to crash.
Yep.
Let's get this over with, right? I'm going to crash today. I'm going to scratch something. I'm going to get cut, right? And just embrace that there's going to be blood on my uniform today.
So how does that lead you in to taking new steps and leaning into fear?
So I'll get real vulnerable.
Please.
I loved snowboarding as a young man, and I have had some pretty epic crashes. And now when I go snowboarding, my son skis, and he's 14 times better than me. He's incredible. He's super fast, and he loves it. I snowboard, he skis. When I get on the mountain now, I have a panic attack the entire time I'm there. Like, my whole body is sweating. My legs are shaking, and I'm like, what is wrong with me? We can do this. Yeah. You know, I fall off the lift. I'm not kidding, right? And so...
Well, you did fall off the lift, or...
Yeah, like when you're getting off.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, I trip and fall, and I'm just like, what's happening to my body?
Got it.
I understand anxiety at a whole new level. That not used to be the case. It's the case now, which is why I go, right? I want to face it. So we just did Powder Mountain, and my son does the first run with me. And then he's like, bye. And I'm like, bye, bud. Have fun. You're welcome.
I'll
for
die
bringing
over
you
here in the corner.
Yeah. So best conditions in the history of my life was last Saturday. And we were going down this run, and everything was coming together, just carving. And it just everything felt right. And I felt fear leaving my body, right? And I was like, actually, I can do this, right? And so this guy next to me, he and I were just kind of in sync. You know, and we were just left and right and left and right. And it was a beautiful run. We get down to the bottom, and we didn't say anything to each other, but we just shared this look. And I was like, that was awesome.
Yes.
And while I'm getting ready to load the lift, there was a group waiting for some friends. Well, this girl was falling. She just kept bop, bop, right? And he yells at her. He yells, trust the speed. And I was like, what did you say? Trust the speed. And that's what I was doing wrong, snowboarding. As I kept trying to control myself from falling, mm-hmm. instead of just opening up and releasing and trusting my edges and trusting the speed, because it would get me down the mountain. And so the next run I just did, and it was amazing. And that became the new best run of my life. And then I couldn't believe it. I never met this guy in my life, but it was the right moment, preceded by a good moment. But trust the speed, I think, is a big thing to think about failure.
So how do you lean into that into your business venture or personal life?
Yeah, so we are in startup. We are preparing a big beta phase to fail, to figure out what we don't understand. And today that happened.
And this is the software.
Yeah, so the name of our company is called Understudy.
Okay.
It is an apprentice management system. And so we are taking the master apprentice model into businesses.
Cool.
So that you can upskill with the talent you have in-house. And so the company is like 12 weeks old. We have like, you know, good ideas and some people willing to test it. But as we meet with our beta customers, we say, hey, like, we want to fail with you, right? And they're like, great. So everybody is eyes wide open that we're going to mess up. And they're cool with it. They're entrepreneurs. They get it. And they want to see us succeed. And so in exchange for that, we're offering them a seat on our board because we're going to do this learning. And so they're actually more excited about that. But I am wise by open about the fact that let's get this failure on, like, let's get it over with so that we can embrace it quickly. And it's just part of business, you know?
I love that you set that expectation, though, with your clients as well. Going to like, hey, we're going to deliver a perfect product to, hey, we're going to screw up and just give us your feedback. That's so much. I mean, you sleep at night.
Oh, yeah. It's like, honesty, right?
When you're like, oh, crap, we failed. Well, I told them that. And they knew that. I knew that. Now let's just put our heads together and solve that problem together.
Yeah.
Because we've been leaning into that. Mike's helped me a ton on that. He's like, okay, let's break some shit. And I was like, what do you mean?
How do we fail today?
He's like, let's push harder and we're just going to break some and then we'll fix it. So it changed the approach a lot to how we were selling our franchises as well. It's like, okay, we're a new and emerging brand. we're going to mess up. But, you know, we will welcome your feedback. And, you know, there's some pros to coming in early. Just know we're going to screw up a little bit.
Yeah.
But we're going to bounce back.
And that's it. That's the trick, is bouncing back.
I had a solar company, and we went from install, and we would just do the sales and the marketing. Mm-hmm. And I was looking for that perfect install, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, this doesn't exist.
Nope.
This is construction. So we landed on a company that it didn't matter that they made mistakes, because they would fix them. So then it wasn't about the pricing. It wasn't about the speed to install. It wasn't about any of that. It was, okay, we're going to make mistakes, because this is permits and different cities and construction. What partner is going to fix it
right
with us? And then we found a really good partner. But yeah, that was like, I was just looking for that perfect insulation. It doesn't happen.
You know what's interesting about failure, though, is that rarely does happiness, right, occur without that. Joy is usually what follows failure, right? Is figuring out what failed and solving that problem. That's joy, right? Is like, oh my gosh, I made it, right?
Same. I mean, yeah, that achievement of like, oh man, look how many obstacles we've ever overcome.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So it's super fun that way.
It's part of the entrepreneurship path, right?
Yep, absolutely. That's how we get the crazy ones.
That's how we get to people buying our product.
Yep.
I mean, we got a couple more. Is there anything else you want to touch on before?
No, this is great. This is great dialogue. This is very real. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, Matt, thank you for being on the show. We've learned so much. Last question. If you can steer someone from not doing something you've already done, what would that be?
Wow. That's a big question. Man, I need to unpack that. I actually wouldn't steer someone. I think there's incredible value in failing. It hurts, and it's supposed to. And if I were to rob you of that moment, you would not grow as a result. I heard something wonderful said today that that the scientific method versus kind of this organic garden approach. So the Western world looks at medicine with your body as a machine. The Eastern world looks at your body as a garden. If you don't allow growth to happen, right, you won't become strong. If you don't have pain, you won't know joy. Mm-hmm. And I would never rob anyone of their own mistakes. And I think that if we try to shortcut them, you yourself don't grow. And it is extremely valuable to be a leader, is to know what it means to hurt. Compassion is the greatest strength any leader can have. It's not sales or, you know, charisma, compassion. A CEO's job is to lead people, not drive metrics. Mm-hmm. And so robbing you of pain would be a travesty, I think.
I love that answer. Matt, thanks for being on the show. Where can we connect with you?
Yeah, sounds great. Where?
Where? Social media, where it sounds like you're not super active, but I'll find you at
Brasa's Tacos. I'm on LinkedIn. Our website's going to launch soon, and there'll be a lot of activity that way. We're going to have a podcast and a really fun YouTube channel. So it's Understudy, II instead of Y. We're really grateful to have had the opportunity to be in a community that's willing to beta test with us. So we're excited.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks for being on the show. And you're a Pleasant Grove local.
Yeah, that's right. PG.
Thank you.
Thanks.